As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from the Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti.
And I'm Natalie Sawyer.
It's fantastic to have you back. You don't know how many complaints we got while you were away.
I don't think you had any, but thank you for having me back. And with us in the studio, it is Mr. James Gearbrandt.
Who's wearing glasses today?
No, he's going to be on fire. And down the line, it is Alan Smith.
You're in Ireland right now, right?
Yeah, fixing the backstop issue.
There you go. Time well spent. Later on, we'll be discussing more away day blues for Arsenal and also an FA Cup classic at Wembley.
But we start with the Champions League quarterfinals kicking off this week with four English clubs represented in the last eight. And of course, two of them face off at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Tuesday. Spurs hosting Manchester City in the first leg. So the question is, how hard does the new venue make this game to predict, Gab?
It's funny, I think to what Kevin De Bruyne said, when he's like, I'm paraphrasing here, but like, stadium? So what? Every team has a stadium. Like, because Spurs have only really played there once, you know, they're still slightly finding their feet. You're kind of in awe. Might take some time for it to come to life. But I also don't think that you need any kind of particular motivation. It's a Champions League quarterfinal. It's huge for Tottenham. And I think it can only be beneficial.
What do you think, James? Does the stadium matter?
Yeah, I think it will have an effect, probably not enough to sort of, you know, completely counteract Manchester City's favourite status. I think they will still be favourites. It's interesting because it kind of comes back to the question of why you think home advantage is an advantage. Is it because of the familiarity of playing somewhere, in which case, you know, obviously barely any more familiar for Tottenham than it is for Manchester City? Is it the psychological boost of it and, you know, sort of the connection you have with your fans and the joy of sort of playing somewhere that, you know, everyone's really happy and excited to be? And I think if it's that, obviously it could have quite a big effect. And of course, one thing to remember is that the old White Hart Lane was somewhere that Tottenham really did have a really big home advantage. I think I'm right in saying in their final Premier League season at White Hart Lane, they won 18 and drew 1. There really seemed to be at the old White Hart Lane a real kind of connection between the fans and the team that really seemed to kind of bring something out of Spurs, draw an extra kind of level of performance. And it will obviously be interesting to see, not just in this game, but obviously over the coming games, whether that endures at the new White Hart Lane.
Alan, do you think Spurs can end City's quadruple hopes?
I struggle to see it happening. Just in terms of the stadium, I'd be kind of interested to see what the atmosphere is actually like, because if you think of that Palace game last week, you could sort of, before Spurs took the lead, you could just, through the sort of TV feed, you could hear Palace fans singing. You couldn't really hear the Spurs fans. I mean, City have been in such good form. It's 14 wins in a row now, and obviously Spurs, despite beating Palace last week, haven't really been that good of late. Of course, there were those couple of defeats to Liverpool, especially the one at Southampton, where they were really, really poor. And I just kind of feel like, on current form, City are operating a level above Spurs, and being two legs, I kind of, you know, really, really fancy City to progress.
I suspect, and we've seen Poch do this before, he might throw some sort of curveball tactically, some sort of something he does different in this game to try to catch Pep off guard. Because obviously Pep can just kind of play his game and he's favoured.
But interestingly, we've seen Pep not do that, haven't we, in previous sort of Champions League quarterfinals. We've seen Pep overcomplicate or try and sort of be almost too clever tactically, like, for example, against Liverpool when he didn't play Sterling, I think, last year, and he played Gundogan instead of Sterling. And I think there was a time at Bayern where he sort of...
It's a good point.
He played a three-man defence.
And remember in his first season when they played Barcelona away, I think, and they got hammered. He dropped Aguero.
Yeah.
And played without sort of a centre forward because he wanted to control the midfield. That's it. That's a good point. proceed, continue.
Well, no, but he's done this a few times where he is tactically sort of overcomplicated, particularly at sort of this stage in the Champions League. So last season, he tried to be, I think, a bit too clever against Liverpool. He dropped Sterling and he played Gundogan instead. There was definitely a time during his time at Bayern when he played, I think it was the year they played Barcelona, and he played a three-man defence, and it was a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah.
Pep definitely does have a bit of a history of getting it wrong in the sort of latter stages of the Champions League.
Alan, are we going to see this, or sort of like Pep sits there and thinks, ooh, Poch is going to try to outfox me, let me outfox him by giving him, and it's like sort of double reverse psychology?
Yeah, I'd be quite interested to see if De Bruyne actually starts, because, you know, he's suddenly come back in the past two games, has impressed quite a bit. And, you know, this would be, again, obviously, a big step up in terms of playing Brighton. You know, no disrespect to Brighton, but at Barcelona and Bayern, he always has this tendency to just sort of overthink matters, whether it's his, you know, maybe perhaps he's doubting himself and he kind of thinks, you know, I need to sort of try something different and do something completely off the wall to catch the manager out. So I'll be quite interested to see the lineup put up, you know, if he keeps them rolling as such. You know, again, I can't see Spurs upsetting City over two legs.
Against that, I would say that I actually think Pep has been noticeably less funky this season. I think, yeah. If you remember, there were times sort of in the past couple of seasons where the Manchester City team sheet would come in and you'd be like, what formation is that? And you just sort of wouldn't. But this season, I think he's actually been noticeably less funky. He's really just, I think particularly for the past, since the turn of the year, he's really just played that 4-3-3 quite consistently, I think.
Well, also on Tuesday night, Liverpool host Porto in the first leg. The Reds beat Porto 5-0 on aggregate in the last 16 last season. And good news is Mo Salah has ended his goal drought.
Everything points to Liverpool, given also that, you know, Porto are embroiled in a really, really tight title race in the Portuguese league. But I just wonder, though, and we had a good piece in the paper with Flinders, who was on Klopp's staff, but worked at Porto for a long time, overseeing different development teams and youth teams. And he just kind of talked about why Porto have been so good over the years and so consistent. And kind of drove the point home to me that this really stung them when they were, you know, when they were sort of so comprehensively overwhelmed last year. And they'll have some sort of plan in place. I'm just looking forward. I wonder, from a neutral's perspective, right, the idea of Pepe against Mo Salah, you know, Pepe now 36 years old, and Iker Casillas between the sticks. Like, they have a couple golden oldies. They have a tremendous, I think, one of the best young defenders in Europe in Eder Militao, who's going to Real Madrid next year. I don't know. I could see this, at least this first leg, turning into the kind of thing where Liverpool don't score early, and then it's a siege, and then, you know, Anfield gets louder and louder, and it's one of those sort of heroic things until Pepe does something silly.
Well, on to Wednesday night, Manchester United take on Barcelona. Since winning at PSG, though, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side have lost three of their last four. You concerned, Alan?
If I was a Manchester United supporter, yes. Obviously, Barcelona have sort of, you know, just beaten Atletico in the league and has opened up an 11-point gap there, so they don't really have to worry about the league anymore. They can sort of really focus on the Champions League. United, that can't be said. Despite Solskjaer's sort of positive work initially when he came in, they're still in sixth position, still fighting to break it, you know, to end up in the top four, and they have wider concerns. In terms of the game itself, I mean, admittedly, I haven't watched every single Barcelona game this season, but, you know, Messi just seems to be kind of still operating on a completely different level. But the players around him tend to kind of have these occasions where they dip, and, you know, they've relied on him quite a bit to sort of dig them out of trouble. But, you know, he's sort of, you kind of think whoever starts a centre-back or whoever starts a back four for United are going to have complete nightmares if he's on form. First leg being at Old Trafford as well, I think, you know, despite the PSG result, should probably play against United, because if they go to the new camp and, you know, need a result, I would fear for them there.
This is one of those things where, you know, Ernesto Valverde hasn't excited a lot of Barcelona fans, but this is, I think, the kind of tie where you're happy he's there because he's going to play it safe. I'm not sure Dembele is going to be back, and which means that he might not play Coutinho and go with just a straight four-man midfield and have somebody deputized to make sure Pogba doesn't create anything, keep his fullbacks low so you don't get caught behind, and wait for Messi to do something in the first leg and see if United get a little bit freaked out, a little bit frenetic, because United can only really beat you so many ways in the current incarnation. And he's very aware that this is a 180-minute clash, and I think a draw would do him just fine. We saw in the last round as well.
If you believe Louis van Gaal, United can only play in one way at the minute, is by counter-attacking. If you saw that interview that he gave to BBC the week before last, and I think, you know, I'm sure Barcelona would be well aware of that, so I kind of agree that, you know, it might not be the first leg, might not be the most free-flowing, and I guess Barcelona would be quite satisfied to sort of take it back to the new camp with things even.
So, James, how do you see this one playing out?
And who do you think Van Gaal will be supporting in this game?
When the draw was made, I thought this was maybe the toughest one to call. I think particularly because at that stage, you know, you really sort of felt the kind of Solskjaer magic was still there. And who knows, maybe it will reappear. But obviously United have dipped. And I think, you know, we've talked about the problems that they've had giving up a ton of shots in their last few games. And Matic really having looked quite poor since he came back. And Young also being a bit of a liability. So I think in some ways it's a shame that this match isn't taking place sort of a month ago when United were on that real high. I think obviously Pogba is key for United. As we've spoken about, I think Barcelona are not by any means infallible. I don't think that the centre-back pairing of Piqué and Longley is that good. United don't appear to be on the kind of top of their form at the moment. So I think obviously Barcelona are clear favourites in this one.
And finally, Ajax face Juventus, Gav. They, of course, knocked out the holders Real Madrid in the last round. So can the Dutch side see off Ronaldo and co?
They did knock out Real Madrid. I mean, I think a lot of things had to come together in that return leg at the Bernabeu after, they lost at home. Logic suggests to me that Juventus, this is their season. This is why they're there. So I think they'll be a lot more conservative, certainly in the first leg, away to Ajax. The suggestion that Cristiano Ronaldo might be back, I'm still a little bit skeptical because it's a muscular injury, so normally you don't necessarily want to take a chance. And let's face it, if you're Juventus, you're supposed to knock out Ajax even without Cristiano, so probably better off to go out there, play it safe in the first leg. You've got Moiseken, who's on fire. I think it's 6 goals in his last 6 games, including internationals. So just do it that way. Take the hit in the first leg and then sort it out at home in the return. So, yeah, I would definitely lean Juve on this one.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Okay, Sunday saw perhaps one of the greatest FA Cup semi-finals of all time. Wolves were 2-0 up with 11 minutes to go at Wembley before an incredible Watford fightback forced extra time and eventually a 3-2 victory. Gab, did you feel the magic of the FA Cup?
I did. I really enjoyed this game. Somebody made the point on Twitter, I forget who, perhaps Michael Cox, that when you have two counter-attacking teams facing each other, and again, I'm not going to be reductive about Wolves and Watford, but they're certainly two teams that counterattack really well. You often either get a really bad game or you get a really good game. And this was definitely a really, really good game. It was fun also to see both teams playing with two strikers up front. Two very different combinations. The way Deeney and Andre Gray combined are very different from the work that Jota does with Raul Jimenez. But yeah, I mean, what a game. And that De La Feu goal, his first goal, you're kind of lost for words because you don't understand with no backlift how he can get under the ball like that and strike it so cleanly. I mean, he looked like some sort of golf wedge or something. I mean, it was pretty remarkable stuff.
Yeah, it certainly was. And Javi Garcia becomes just the second Watford manager to take them to an FA Cup final after the late Graham Taylor back in 1984. So, James, sum up the job that Garcia has done at Watford.
I think Gracia has done a superb job. I mean, obviously, I think if you look at, not just saying this because they played them yesterday, but I think in terms of their results this season, obviously Watford are very, very similar to Wolves in both in their league position and in how well they've done in the Cups. And obviously Nuno, I think, has rightly come in for a huge amount of credit. But I think there's an argument that Javier Gracia has done as much with probably less. The Watford squad, you know, I think it's fine, but it's not. I don't think it's a great squad with maybe the kind of individual attacking quality that Wolves have, for example. Obviously, they do have some good players, but I think Gracia has done an outstanding job. I think obviously he came in and at the end of last season he really kind of tightened them up a bit defensively. They do, as Gab said, play mainly on the counter-attack, but I think he's done an outstanding job. There was actually, I think, if you remember at the start of this season, I think a few people actually tipped Watford for relegation, and that sort of didn't feel like a kind of totally outrageous shout at the time. So I think he's been absolutely superb.
Alan, this is where I wind you up, since you're the ex-pro here, because when ex-pros don't know what to say about teams, they have a bunch of British players, they talk about the importance of the British spine. So obviously Ben Foster didn't play yesterday, but you know he's been a big part of it. And you've got Craig Cathcart at the back, Will Hughes, Andre Gray, Troy Deeney. Is that the secret? Is it that the British spine, which is so important?
I know Gracia has spoken in the past quite a bit about it's more about senior players behind the scenes. And he sort of made a point after the quarterfinals. After the quarterfinals, the big Crystal Palace. And he made a point specifically about Aurelio Gomez, who obviously has been sitting on the bench throughout the league because Foster has been, you know, really, really good, making the point that having these older pros who aren't necessarily involved but are taking on this leadership role in the dressing room, and I think they now call Gomez the captain of the bench because he's been obviously been sitting on the sidelines throughout the league. And I think that's probably a far bigger deal. They've got quite a few sort of players who, you know, who have been around the block. And I think, I mean, Didi's sort of, it's such a great story in the sense that, you know, he's come from sort of, you know, he obviously had these off-the-field difficulties several years ago, and he mentioned in a couple of post-match interviews after yesterday's game that, you know, several seasons back he was actually paying to play football. So, you know, the journey he's been on is quite remarkable. And I think in many senses, he's, you know, he's a role model to a lot of people in terms of, you know, someone who can sort of rehabilitate themselves from being in this, you know, the tricky position to becoming, you know, a really good footballer, first of all, and also somebody who's quite, you know, he's got this sort of way of getting under opponents' skin, which I quite enjoy usually. I found the sort of the dig at Raul Jimenez over wearing the mask at full time yesterday a little bit weird, and in the sense that, you know, he's just qualified for an FA Cup final. I wouldn't really be too concerned about sort of having a go at the opposition striker for how he celebrated his goal.
In fact, Troy Deeney said about Raul Jimenez's mask, quote, "There's a bit of me that wants to say something nasty, but I won't. I'm glad he put that mask on. Now he can wear it out now. He's a loser." Is this kind of overstepping the mark, or is it just also kind of maybe don't wear a mask when, you know, you score your 2-0 up, but there was still, what, like a good half hour to go?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a silly celebration, but I just thought that, I think, Didi's thought process in terms of, you know, that's come into his head when, you know, should be celebrating reaching the final, but why is this sort of bothering you now, sort of after the game? And I just found it a little bit of a strange dig. Do you know if he, like, ran behind the goal before sort of the second half kicked off to drop the mask? Because it seemed like it was actually kind of waving behind the net for him to pick up.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I don't know how it's
the logistics. And also,
Facundo Sava used to keep it tucked down his shin pad.
Yeah.
Was it his shin pad or was it his shorts?
I seem to remember Facundo Sava had it tucked down his shin pad. But right.
That was a smaller mask, too.
Yeah, but
and Raul Jimenez has a larger head, too.
As it was, Wolves, as we were saying, 11 minutes to go. It was all looking very good for them. So how did they let it slip away, James?
I mean, Nuno actually said words to those effect. He said something like, "We have to accept that we had it and we let it get away." I think Nuno will reflect that maybe they maybe went a bit too defensive after they scored the second goal and they just sort of stopped playing. And then obviously there's the kind of the question of Nuno's substitutions. He obviously took off Ruben Neves and Diogo Jota. And obviously, Watford then equalised in stoppage time.
Do you know why he took off Ruben Neves?
Well, I think just to kind of to sort of shore it up, basically. But that'd be weird to take off Neves. I don't know.
Of all people, you would think. I mean, assuming he must have had a knock. The Jota one, I can see. Hindsight being 20/20, you always want to leave Jota on because he can dribble, he can win a free kick or whatever. But by the same token, if you know you've got some pretty quick players on the bench, you're going to play on the counter, maybe there's somebody else you want to have on, although maybe not Cav. But yeah, that was the Neves one was odd. I'm assuming he must have had a knock.
Maybe. I think those two changes combined somewhat neutered, although he did obviously bring on Adama Traore later, but I think had the effect of somewhat kind of neutering Wolves' attacking threat in that 30-minute period of extra time. It's always difficult, and Nuno, of course, would have known that, and when he took Jota off, it's the kind of the gamble that you take. You know that you're trying to shore it up for the remainder of normal time, but you also know that there's extra time, and I suppose potentially penalties. I suppose Jota would probably have been a penalty taker had it got that far. That's the gamble that you take, and I'm sure Nuno would have weighed that up, and I think ultimately that gamble didn't pay off.
So it is Watford then who will face Manchester City in next month's final. I'm going to ask you all, starting with you, Alan, do you give Watford any chance against City?
No. I don't. I mean, I was kind of thinking, you think about Wigan winning the FA Cup a couple of years back and sort of the sign that, these shocks can happen. But depending on how the next few weeks go for City and whether they kind of, if they are indeed fighting to win the quadruple, I just couldn't give Watford much of a chance.
James?
I think I would give Watford maybe a 25 or 30% chance. It's a one-off game. Watford are good. They're not as good as Manchester City. That Manchester City defence has been pretty outstanding since the turn of the year, but I think they're certainly, I think Watford are certainly better equipped to give Manchester City a good game than, for example, Brighton were in the semi-final. But yeah, I mean, obviously City will be heavy favourites.
Come on, Gab, give the Watford fans something to cheer about.
Yeah, no, I'm with James. I mean, I think they have a shot. I mean, it's 25-30%. I'm not sure about the Wigan analogy, given that Wigan got relegated last year and Watford won't be relegated this year. They can actually sit there and just prepare for the final week in, week out, and just throw the rest of the games of the season if they want to. Whereas City obviously have a bunch of bigger fish to fry. That midfield of Doucouré and Kapu, if they're on their day, I think is as good as almost any midfield in the Premier League. And the other thing is they have a lot of size. And I know they haven't maybe exploited set pieces as much or as well as they could have. But that's one area where on paper, again, if you remember under Pellegrini and when Pep first got there, it felt like City were conceding a lot on set pieces because this is not a very big team physically. Between Mariappa, the two central midfielders, both of whom are tall, and Troy Deeney's certainly a huge load, and Andre Gray can get up there too, and they've got guys who can do who can put the ball in the box effectively. So I don't think this is a foregone conclusion at all.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A Earlier on Sunday, Arsenal missed the chance to go third in the Premier League, losing 1-0 to Everton at Goodison Park. Now, there are only two teams in the top four divisions in England who haven't kept a clean sheet away from home this season. One is Arsenal, the other is Ipswich, who are bottom of the Championship. Gab, why are they so leaky on their travels, Arsenal?
I don't know. And why are they so incredibly inconsistent? I thought this was like, you know, good Arsenal. Was it they won like five in a row or something? It boggles the mind how they could play so bad. And I don't want to take anything away from Everton. They were obviously hugely motivated. They strung a couple good results together. They have good players. They seem to be first to every ball. You gave up a goal from a freaking throw-in, which really should never happen. And, you know, the guy who scores it turns 37 this summer, Jagielka, shouldn't have even been playing. But even in the second half, when they seem incapable of attacking without conceding at the back. And I don't think you can just go and dump this all on Mustafi and Papastathopoulos. There was obviously a breakdown in midfield. Elneny didn't shield the way he should have, which is why he came off at halftime. But I just think mentally they really weren't right for this game. And that, to me, is something that really ought to be a concern for Arsenal.
It's interesting because obviously I think clearly Unai Emery has improved this team a bit. I think they've already, you know, obviously before this game, had matched last season's points total. So, I mean, you kind of have to say Unai Emery has improved them a bit. But to me, they're very similar to what they were under Arsene Wenger. They're just a kind of slightly better version of what they were. I mean, they're very, very good at home. They have games at home where they're sort of very freewheeling in attack. And, you know, they can really sort of devastate teams. You know, they obviously have a lot of pace and individual quality in attack, but that's very inconsistent away. They still seem to have, you know, this certain kind of fragility or softness when they go away from home. And they're, you know, they're really, really inconsistent would be a kind of polite way of putting it defensively. They're just not very good defensively. They're an average Premier League team defensively.
Well, Gylfi Sigurdsson had as many shots as the whole Arsenal team combined, so it was a poor performance all over the pitch for Unai Emery's side. And Alan, given their away form, given that four of their last six games are away from home, can they finish in the top four?
I still think they can, based on not being entirely convinced by Chelsea or Manchester United. Three of those four away games are Watford, Wolves and I think Leicester, which are all big tests. Considering they're sort of, you know, those three teams are still fighting to be sort of considered the best of the rest.
Chelsea, Alan, I'm going to jump in and rudely interrupt you here. Because you never quite know. When you place those teams, Watford, Wolves, and Leicester, when you face those teams in April and May, and those are teams that have had good seasons, Watford obviously will be looking ahead to the FA Cup final. Leicester are on a great run. We're going to talk about them. Wolves are a good team. But aren't there motivational issues? I mean, we see this every year. Isn't this who you want to be facing late in the season rather than teams that have something to play for?
I wouldn't be too sure in terms of Watford, because you're going to have players who are sort of, you know, cliche as it sounds, fighting for a place in the final, in their place in the team. Gracia has sort of spoken about the depth of the squad and how he sort of keeps every position sort of open until sort of the day before game, before deciding. Obviously, which doesn't apply to all 11 positions, but, you know, he does like to kind of keep options available. Wolves, you know, have shown throughout the season that they really do thrive against the top six, and, you know, those games seem to suit them far more than they do against lesser opponents, because they can sit back and they can break with the pace they have on the counter attack. And Leicester have been, you know, since Brendan Rodgers has come in, have been in really, really good form. The reason why I do think Arsenal still, you know, have a very good chance of finishing fourth is that because Chelsea have been obviously quite erratic, have to go to Anfield, also have to go to Old Trafford. United have to play City, and of course then have to play Chelsea as well. So, you know, they're going to be dropping points along the way as well. So I wouldn't rule, you know, Arsenal are in fourth, and, you know, I'd still consider them perhaps favourites of those three to still finish up there.
Gab, you mentioned there previously about not wanting to take anything away from Everton. So let's look at the Everton perspective. Three clean sheets in a row, four clean sheets in five. James, are we seeing things starting to click under Marco Silva?
Yeah, it does seem to be that way. This was sort of a combination of of a, I thought, a really poor attacking Arsenal performance, but I do think Everton played really well. This Everton squad, as we kind of thought at the start of the season, this squad has a lot of individual quality, I think. You know, I think that midfield double pivot of Idrissa Gueye and Andre Gomes is potentially really, really good. And
what do you think of Calvert-Lewin? Because I know he doesn't score a lot of goals and everything. You know, I thought he had a tremendous game. He seems very awkward to play against. And I think one of the things people often might talk about is athleticism or whatever, but I think his movement is really, really good. He's always looking to try to favor teammates. You know, he's busy, but he doesn't waste energy. It's in an intelligent way.
Yeah, I really like Calvert-Lewin, in common with a lot of the sort of that generation of young centre forwards. Whether he can score regularly at the top level remains to be seen, but I like him personally.
So you might have noticed that we don't have any predictions to tot up, but obviously while you were away...
You hammered me, I'm sure.
Yes, Natalie, I beat you both weeks, so the score is now 15-14. So let's move on to quick hits. Manchester City has predicted down Brighton 1-0, and there's not much to say about them that we haven't already said. But, Gearbrandt, you have some interesting theories about Chris Hughton's approach that you wrote about in the newspaper.
Well, I just thought one thing that was interesting about Brighton on Saturday was that on a seven-man bench, it didn't have a single midfielder. Chris Hughton went with three defenders and three forwards, basically, and ultimately brought on his three forwards, Andone, Izquierdo and Locadia. And obviously we have to say, in fairness to Brighton, they are missing Pascal Gross, who I think was a big miss. But to me, it felt like that was a bit of a mistake, maybe, because he threw on the three forwards, and what you eventually had was a real kind of front-loaded team where you had lots of kind of attackers, but not really anyone to convey the ball upfield effectively. And I think it was quite telling that...
You get Lewis Dunk to boot it from the back.
Well, yeah. I mean, or, you know, someone to knock it in from a set piece. But I think it was quite telling that Brighton's three substitutes combined for a total of two completed passes, which...
Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
That didn't go according to plan.
No.
Crystal Palace grab 3 points away to Newcastle, but let's face it, both teams probably are safe this season. So, Alan, let's talk about instead Luka Milivojevic, who has converted 10 penalties this season, one shy of the record. What's more surprising, that he's scored so many or that Palace have been awarded that many?
Well, according to Milivojevic, all the credit should go to Sam Allardyce, because they weren't really taking many penalties before Allardyce came in at Crystal Palace, and then they began practicing, and he said he was sort of second choice and then has come into first choice. And he scored 10 of the 11. I think he'd missed. There's a nice graphic in this morning's paper which sort of shows where each attempt sort of went, and the only one he sent down the middle was actually saved by Pickford earlier in the season. I think, you know, if you're to believe Wolf Zaha, who said that, you know, he said earlier in the season that he would need to have his leg broken for an opponent to be sent off, you'd be surprised that they've won so many penalties. And if you actually look at it, Zaha has been fouled for six of those, which I actually found slightly surprising, because I think sometimes, you know, he is harshly done by referees, but, you know, it's quite interesting to know that. And also, one other thing was that the record holder is actually Andy Johnson, who said it while at Palace, I think, in 2004-05. So that's a nice...
My memory of Andy Johnson that year with all those goals and all those penalties is just generally involves him falling over in the box. I mean, I bet he won all his penalties. Like, here it's more of a team effort between Zaha and Milivojevic. But... Andy Johnson, that was a real solo affair. Natalie, one for you. Now, I remember the Cowley brothers and their big FA Cup run with non-league Lincoln 2 years ago. What are they up to now?
Well, you're right about the FA Cup. They reached the quarterfinals 2 years ago, and a few weeks later they were promoted to the Football League. Now, Danny Cowley's men are the leaders of League Two, on the verge of promotion to the third tier for the first time in 20 years. They won 2-0 at second place MK Dons on Saturday, meaning they are just now one win away from promotion. 5,500 Lincoln fans made the trip to Milton Keynes. That's their biggest away following of the century. That's bigger than on their cup run as well. And if, as expected, they go up, it'll be a second promotion in 3 years under the Cowleys.
And they're both there, right? The brother and, and the brother.
Yeah, the brother and the brother. I mean... Danny and his bro.
What's the brother's name? Do we know?
Nicky.
Danny and Nicky.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
There you go. So, yeah, look out for Lincoln next season in League One, perhaps. Now, James, I know you like numbers, so how about these? Bournemouth lost at home to Burnley, which means they have won 1 of 9 since January. It's been a similar story in previous years, leading Eddie Howe to review how they work. So any theories as to why they suddenly stopped performing in spring?
I have a very kind of irrational Eddie Howe theory. Oh. It also involves Sean Dyche.
Is that why you've got the glasses on?
Yes. I've come with the glasses prepared to live in my conspiracy theory. My theory is that Eddie Howe and Sean Dyche, who some would argue are the two kind of foremost English managers of their generation, I think overall are both good managers in very different ways. But there seems to be some sort of glitch in the space-time continuum where they can never be good at the same time. Eddie Howe's Bournemouth and Sean Dyche's Burnley are never doing well at the same time. When Burnley are doing well, Bournemouth are terrible. And this season, Bournemouth had a really good start to the season and Burnley were obviously abject. And now Burnley have kind of obviously started to play quite well again since the turn of the year. Bournemouth are really poor again. Clearly, that's the only rational explanation for this sudden decline in Bournemouth's form.
Alison isn't here, so I can say this. If the league began when he was appointed, Brendan Rodgers would be right up near the top of the table. I haven't figured it out, but I'm sure Brendan has. Alan, is it the Rodgers effect? Is there such a thing? Or is it that Leicester have some absurdly good players, from Wilfred Ndidi to Youri Tielemans, from James Maddison to Ricardo Pereira to whoever else you care to name, and that maybe it was actually Claude Puel who was screwing everything up before?
Obviously, the squad had been playing below par in sort of Puel's final weeks, but then you sort of look at the opponents Rodgers has faced. Lost to Watford in his first game, but since then they've played Fulham, Burnley, Bournemouth and Huddersfield. Not exactly the biggest challenge. I think they have improved drastically, and I think Youri Tielemans has been, you know, obviously on loan, but he has been really, really good since joining. You do look at their remaining fixtures and you kind of think, I think with Newcastle and West Ham next, and then after that they face Arsenal, Man City and Chelsea. So, you know, the winning run may continue in the next two fixtures, but beyond that, I think we may see a bigger test of Rodgers' managerial genius.
You know what's funny? While he was talking, I was listening to him, of course, but Alan, I was working out a combined Leicester-Arsenal 11. It's really, really close. In fact, there might even be more Leicester players in there than Arsenal players. I mean, you take Schmeichel over Leno, right?
Yeah.
No. You take...
No, absolutely not. I think Leno's been...
You have a thing for Leno. Is
no,
there
not
weird,
at all. I think Leno's been really good this season.
You take Ricardo Pereira over Bellerin any day of the week, also because the guy's injured and can't walk. The centre-backs, I'm a big Socrates guy, but Harry Maguire's pretty darn good and probably better than Mustafi or 40-year-old Koscielny. Chilwell's an England international, yeah. I mean, I'm impressed. Would you take Chilwell over in your combined 11?
In a back four, Chilwell, yeah.
Yes, okay. We're playing back four the way God intended, right? would you have Torreira in the centre of midfield? Maybe, but then...
I love Leicester's midfielders. I think they've...
You love Tielemans because he's Belgian, like you.
Tielemans and Didi.
So no room for Torreira and Granit and... Do you see what I'm driving at here?
It's tough, yeah. I mean...
Madison? I mean...
I like Madison. I probably would have Madison as well.
Would you take Vardy over Laka or Ava? No, I didn't think so. But still, it's a really good side.
Leicester top-heavy, basically.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, the in terms of wages and spending, there may be a big gap between top six and everything else. In terms of actual quality players, and I think we need to give a shout-out to who does the recruitment here and the youth development, in the case of obviously Madison and Barnes. Well, I guess Madison came from Norwich, but Barnes and Chilwell and Damari Gray.
Chowdhury.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a really, really good side, a really talented side.
Okay, Gab, one for you. You wrote about Bayern's 5-0 thumping of Borussia Dortmund in the German Clásico, yet you still don't seem impressed.
No, I mean, I was impressed with Bayern obviously turning the tide again, and they lost the momentum and they gained it back, and now they're up by point. But Dortmund were terrible in this game. So many individual errors. What was impressive, people like Hummels and Thomas Müller, who some had written off, came up really big in this game. But like I said, Dortmund made it easy for them. And I think, looking forward, I was kind of surprised to learn that Bayern have the fifth highest wage bill in Europe, behind Real Madrid, Barcelona, and the two Manchester sides. There's not that much to show for it. I think a lot of the teams kind of gone a tiny bit stale. And it'll be interesting to see where they've spent their money on in the summer is actually on two defenders, and Pavard and Lucas Hernandez, two World Cup winners. But you kind of look at it and you say, all right, well, three of their four defenders, Alaba, Kimmich, and Niklas Süle, are pretty darn good. And then you also have Boateng and Hummels. So then did you really need two more defenders? I suppose Kimmich can play midfield. I don't really see the clarity of vision going forward. So stand to be corrected. But they are on their way to making it, what, 6 in a row, 7 in a row? Absurd.
I did see the goals, and the defending from Borussia Dortmund was just shambolic.
Yeah. You see Zagadou? Poor guy. He's just a kid, but whatever.
Oh, dear. Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Gearbrand and Alan Smith.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times, and you also get The Sunday Times, too, with that. And you'll enjoy award-winning journalism online, but also on your smartphone or tablet. Just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information.
We'll be back on Thursday, looking ahead to Liverpool versus Chelsea.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.